Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, May 6th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. 8 COVID-19 cases now in Webster County. 2 more positive COVID-19 cases have been confirmed in Webster County since Monday, bringing the county's total to 8, according to Webster County Public Health. Before Tuesday, existing infections fell into the following age categories: adults age 18 to 40, 3, middle-aged adults age 41 to 60, 2, older adults age 61 to 80, 1. Webster County's count was 6 on Monday. The age categories and hospitalization status of the most recent 2 cases could not be immediately confirmed. The new cases join another 408 in Iowa, announced Tuesday by the Iowa Department of Public Health. Statewide, a total of 10,111 people have tested positive since the pandemic began. Another 19 Iowans with COVID-19 died before Governor Kim Reynolds' Tuesday press conference, the highest death number yet reported in a single day, bringing the total number of deaths in the state to 207. Webster County has not yet experienced any deaths from COVID-19. A total of 674 people have been tested in Webster County, less than 2% of the county's population. Integrating services. With $4 million grant, Berryhill hopes to reach more people. Macon, 23 jobs could be added in the county. With the help of $4 million in federal funding, mental health services will be expanded and become more inclusive for Webster County residents, according to Aaron Macon, director of Unity Point Health, Berryhill Center. Berryhill has been awarded a Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinic grant by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, which is part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The grant is worth $2 million annually for 2 years. It has the possibility for renewal after the initial grant duration. The CCBHC program was created in 2016 in response to Section 223 of the Protecting Access to Medicare Act to develop resources that provide accessible, comprehensive services to individuals experiencing a mental health crisis or substance use disorder, regardless of their ability to pay. Macon found out on April 27th that the grant would be awarded in Webster County. Ordinarily, the grant would not have been awarded until August, but the COVID-19 pandemic changed that. With the COVID pandemic and coordination with CARES, the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, the government doubled the amount of awards nationwide that was to be released, Macon said. In Webster County, Macon said the grant isn't just about Berryhill. It's a lot more than Berryhill, Macon said. This is to establish Certified Community Behavioral Health Clinic. That new distinction requires expanded care coordination with other healthcare providers, social service providers, and law enforcement in the community. It has a focus on whole health and comprehensive access to a full range of medical, behavioral, and supportive services, according to Macon. Berryhill has been a community health mental health center and now are going to become a certified community behavioral health clinic, and essentially what that means is we look after people holistically, Macon said. 2 major partners of Berryhill will be Community and Family Resources and Central Iowa Recovery. They are both helping us in this grant, Macon said. Macon, who has been director of Berryhill since 2013, said historically things like depression or anxiety would be treated separately from substance abuse and aspects of physical health. CCBHC aims to bring each of those areas together. We are trying to assure we are treating people in an integrated fashion, Macon said, treating them for everything they have going on. Macon said the CCBHC will be for all ages. In this, we are locking arms with CFR and CIR, and the 3 of us are seeking to establish a network of services here in Webster County to treat all people, whether their primary concern is mental health or substance abuse, just trying to get our arms around that, Macon said. In 2019, Berryhill served 3,158 Webster County residents, or 8.7% of the county's population. The goal is to provide services to 10%, according to Macon. He said about 20% of the U.S. population at any given time has a diagnosable mental health disorder. That's something we are seeing here, McCone said. But a lot of people don't need specialized behavioral health treatment. About 10% need specialized mental health care. We hope to serve 10% in this integrated way. We do want to help people we know are out there who aren't accessing services. In its staffing plan submitted in the grant application, McCone said 23 positions would be added to solidify the CCBHC. The bulk of it is relating to providing additional services, he said. For example, crisis services I think we could do better in this community. We can hire a psychiatric nurse at Trinity. We can also provide crisis services at the Berry Health Center, which we actually started April 3rd. A mobile crisis response service will also be rolled out, although McCone said that will be more challenging in a time of social distancing. Nonetheless, we plan to develop a way to get help to people in real time who need it on a 24/7 basis, McCone said. COVID-19 has added another layer to mental health. It's a high anxiety time for a lot of people, McCone said. Trying to get used to that new normal. One of the things we know is after a traumatic event like this, it can create scars that just don't go away. As I look at the state of this pandemic and this grant, I'm starting to think differently about how we can relieve that trauma that people will go through and keep us whole on the other side. McCone said Berryhill is serving about 100 people a day through telehealth. More counselors and case managers will also be brought to the community through the grant. Counselors, there is a little bit of a shortage, and case managers, to make sure they are getting what they need, McCone said. McCone said things like stable housing have a huge impact on mental health. Oftentimes, what patients really need is stable housing, having their food needs met, and transportation, he said. That can go a long ways in improving their mental health. McCone said the funding will help more people get the care they deserve. We are extremely grateful to have received the CCBHC grant, McCone said. This grant will allow us to expand community-based behavioral health care in Webster County with the goal of improving people's physical and mental health care and well-being close to home. Berryhill is one of 98 organizations nationally to receive this federal grant. They join two other CCBHC facilities already in Iowa, Abbey Mental Health Center in Cedar Rapids, an affiliate of Unity Point Health, and Seasons Center for Behavioral Health in Spencer. Fresh eyes. Humboldt welcomes new high school principals. Humboldt High School will welcome new leadership this fall. Following the early retirement of Principal Lori Westhoff, Dr. Paul Noomdahl will take the reins at Humboldt High School. Noomdahl, who is currently the assistant principal at Palmer Ridge High School in Monument, Colorado, received his bachelor's degree in biology from the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. He earned his master's degree and doctorate in curriculum and instruction from the University of Iowa in Iowa City. Noomdahl will be joined by assistant principal Abby Horbach, who has a bachelor's and master's degrees from UNI. Horbach is currently the K-5 school counselor at College View Elementary School in Council Bluffs. Previously, she had been an 8th grade math teacher in the Waterloo Community School District. Noomdahl and Horbach are just two of several new district leaders for Humboldt. Jim Murray, the new superintendent for Humboldt, has also hired two new elementary school principals, one of whom was also hired to be the director of curriculum, and a new middle school assistant principal. Typically, in many districts, you might get one new administrator or two, Murray said. But with as many as we have, we're going to get a lot of stakeholder feedback from all levels, elementary, middle, and high school. So we should get a very good view of what is going well and what might need to improve. Murray said he hopes the new perspectives brought by the new administrators will be an asset for the Humboldt Community School District. I think we're all going to have fresh eyes when we come in, a fresh perspective of education, and I look forward to that, he said. Murray feels that Horbach brings a great deal of experience with developing relationships with families and, with her counseling background, supporting at-risk students and those who are struggling with mental health. Noomdahl, Murray said, brings a strong background in curriculum assessment, teacher development, and instructional leadership. I think both prioritize establishing relationships, he said. Though Noomdahl has been teaching in Colorado for the past several years, he is a native of Decorah, and he and his wife were looking to moving back to be closer to family and continue their careers in Iowa. Noomdahl's wife is an elementary school teacher and will teach in the Twin Rivers Community School District. We really wanted a community-minded atmosphere that really supported education, and education really supported community values, and that's what we found in Humboldt, Noomdahl said. The new principal is ready to get started at Humboldt High School this fall. The big thing I'm really looking forward to is getting to know the community, school staff, students, and parents, he said, really understanding those traditions and legacy that are part of Humboldt School District. Noomdahl doesn't have any grand plans of making changes. He plans to learn and listen to the needs of the district and its stakeholders and work together to best support the school. I'm a big relationship guy, he said. I think we can all do better if we're actually working on something in a cooperative, collaborative way. Horbach was also looking to continue her career in North Central Iowa when she applied for the assistant principal position at HHS. She already had some friends and family that live in the area and was also looking for a job in a good school district for when she decides to start her family, she said. When I started researching the district, I was like, wow, this is definitely somewhere I want to be, she said. This is somewhere I want to be long term. Horbach said she's most looking forward to getting to know the students this fall. I'm really excited to be a part of an awesome community, she said. Working with a new group of administrators, working toward one goal, is going to be super exciting because I think we will all work well together. We all kind of have the same mindset, which is great. Noomdahl's starting salary with the district will be $117,700 annually. Horbach's starting salary will be $92,700 annually. Tentative date set for FDSH commencement. The Fort Dodge Senior High Class of 2020 may still have the opportunity to wear their Dodger red caps and gowns to walk across the stage and accept their high school diplomas. The Fort Dodge Community School District announced Tuesday night its plans to host commencement on July 26th at Dodger Stadium. We know how important this is to students and families, said Jennifer Lane, FDCSD Director of Communications and Community Relations. Commencement was originally scheduled for May 31st. It was canceled due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Lane said the district is postponing graduation in hopes of being able to hold an in-person ceremony. We will be following all social distancing guidelines given by the state at that time, which could include limiting the number of guests per graduate and different seating arrangements than in the past, Lane said. Contingency plans are being made in the event we are still unable to gather in large groups at this time. The district also announced the cancellation of prom. We understand this is disappointing, Lane said, but our top priority is keeping our students, staff, and families safe at this time. Class night, which was scheduled for May 28th, will not be held in person. We are currently working on a virtual option to share the scholarship and award announcements that would have been made that night, Lane said. Stay tuned for more details on what this will look like and when it will be released. Lane acknowledged the disappointment in not being able to close the year as anticipated, but she said the district looks forward for the chance to host a commencement later this summer. We know this was not the way any of you expected to end your Dodger experience, she said. We also know that you are a strong, resilient group who will use this experience to make our world a better place. We are hopeful we will be able to celebrate with you on July 26th. Sac County man charged with sex abuse. A Sac County man faces two charges after police say he had sex with a child. Nathan Landrum, 39, was arrested Friday after the Sac County Sheriff's Office says he had sex with a child aged 12 or 13 last Thursday. A Sac County sergeant responded to a request for assistance at Trailside Roadhouse in Carnarvon that day, referencing a juvenile that ran away and was inside a building with Landrum, criminal complaints said. While speaking with the victim, it appeared that something else had taken place, the complaint said. After speaking with the victim's mother, the officer looked at the minor's phone, where he found a sexual conversation between Landrum and the victim. During an interview, the victim told her mother that intercourse had happened with the defendant, with what may have been physical evidence of the act left on the victim's pants. Landrum is charged with third-degree sexual abuse, a Class C felony, and lascivious acts with a child, a Class D felony. He is held in Sac County Jail on a $10,000 cash or surety bond. Physician assistant's license restored after suspension. Sexual exploitation lawsuit against Unity Point moves forward. A lawsuit filed by a Unity Point health patient moves forward. A Fort Dodge physician assistant accused of sexually exploiting the patient has had his license fully restored. Mervyn Casey IV, 33, received notice from the Iowa Board of Physician Assistants that his license was returned to full privilege status, free of restrictions, on March 26th, after a probationary period. His license was reinstated on August 9th, 2019, after a voluntary year of suspension that started in May 2018. Casey self-reported an inappropriate relationship he pursued outside of his practice with a patient under his care for mental health and chronic pain management. His license was reinstated after completion of a sexual misconduct evaluation, substance abuse treatment, and a board-approved boundaries program. Though he said there's no guarantee inappropriate boundary issues won't reoccur, licensed psychologist Dr. Louise Roselle said that a reoccurrence is improbable given his motivation to achieve goals and positive response to interventions, according to documents filed in his application to reinstate his license. A boundaries and ethics plan submitted by Casey said that he would continue with therapy, attending Alcoholics Anonymous, would not share personal information with patients, and would use chaperones for patient encounters. Casey pleaded guilty in October 2018 to misdemeanor charges of obstructing a prosecution and unlawfully possessing Adderall. He was sentenced to 2 years probation. Even though the victim in the case settled civil claims with him for $25,000, co-defendants Trimark Physicians Clinic and Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center, named in the lawsuit filed nearly a year ago, have not yet been released. The lawsuit claims that Unity Point failed to exercise due diligence in supervising Casey, have proper policies addressing therapist-patient boundaries, fully investigate Casey's background, and restrict his access to patient records for personal gratification. An attorney for Unity Point Health rejected those claims. The undisputed facts will also show a record devoid of any evidence of negligent retention, hiring, and/or supervision by these defendants of Mervyn Casey, said attorney Joseph Fitzgibbons for the defendants in a motion for summary judgment filed April 2nd. After several months of treating the plaintiff, the lawsuit says that Casey gave the patient his phone number in March 2018. He then contacted her with the phone number she gave to Unity Point Health. The lawsuit delves into graphic details of a relationship that escalated from a professional one to a sexual one, including acts of sadomasochism between the physician assistant and patient. The plaintiff alleges that Casey administered oxycodone to her through sexual acts. A hearing on the defendant's motion to dismiss the lawsuit is scheduled for June 8th. A trial has been tentatively scheduled to start August 11th. Court records show that Casey settled directly with the plaintiff after he struggled to find an attorney he could afford to represent him in the sizable lawsuit exceeding $10,000. Court records indicate that Unity Point refused to provide legal defense for Casey, according to a letter filed with the court in September 2019 that asked the court to delay rendering a default judgment. It is unclear if Casey is still employed by Unity Point. The plaintiff has demanded a jury trial to hear claims of emotional distress caused in part by negligence from the healthcare providers. Celebrating our nurses, Katie Thomas. Editor's note, in honor of National Nurses Week, The Messenger is featuring one nurse a day for 7 days from Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center. Name, Katie Thomas, registered nurse, Bachelor of Science in Nursing. Hometown, Fort Dodge. What department do you work in at Unity Point Health Trinity Regional Medical Center? Surgery. What clinical areas have you worked in? Post-anesthesia care and urgent care. How long have you worked in healthcare? 10 years. What's an interesting fact or two that someone might not know about you? I am a wife, mother of two beautiful boys, and a hog farmer. We have up to 6,000 hogs on our acreage. What is the toughest part about your job? Seeing patients and family members worried or fearful about having to have surgery. What gives you satisfaction as a nurse? Knowing I had a positive impact on the behind-the-scenes work, literally removing someone's cancer or fixing their internal problems. How has the COVID-19 pandemic changed what you do on a daily basis? I am helping out in other departments and learning new roles. I also have a better awareness for infection prevention than ever before. What's the best part of your day? Being able to be there for patients at such a vulnerable time in their life. Unity Point Health requests that all patients wear masks. To help prevent further spread of COVID-19, Unity Point Health is requesting everyone who enters their hospitals, clinics, and facilities to wear masks or face coverings. Starting today, staff, patients, and visitors will be encouraged to wear their own personal cloth mask or face covering upon entering a Unity Point Health facility. Infants and young children under the age of 2 do not need to wear a mask because often masks don't fit properly, and young children struggle to keep them on without touching them. To conserve surgical masks and other personal protective equipment for healthcare workers, Unity Point Health is asking patients and visitors to partner with them by bringing their own masks as part of the regular routine. As we continue to practice social distancing, everyone should get in the habit of keeping a mask or face covering with you at all times, said Dr. Megan Romine. These face coverings help protect patients, healthcare workers, and the community at large. Based on availability, some locations may be able to provide masks for patients and visitors that don't have one. However, facilities with high patient volume may not be able to accommodate everyone who doesn't have a mask. The All-American. Flores honored for banner season at Georgia Tech. Victoria Flores took her most recent collegiate honor in stride. The Fort Dodge native hopes the best is yet to come in her career as a Georgia Tech Yellow Jacket. Flores was recently named an Intercollegiate Tennis Association All-American in doubles competition alongside senior teammate Kenya Jones. Flores, a junior, went 20-3 in doubles during the spring season with Jones, and the duo achieved a top 6 national ranking for their efforts, according to the ITA. "The honor means so much to me," said Flores, the daughter of Fort Dodge's Manny and Marianne Flores. "I wouldn't say I was surprised by the news, but I knew that if I kept focused on my goals and working hard like I have been since last summer, it was definitely something I could achieve." The 21-year-old Flores also posted a 20-7 singles mark to rank 41st nationally. Georgia Tech went 15-6 overall and 5-2 in the Atlantic Coast Conference, qualifying for the ITA National Team Indoor Championships. "I obviously had a chance of reaching All-American status in singles too," said Flores, who attended both Fieldhaver Elementary and Fair Oaks Middle School. "That was my highest ranking so far in college, but hopefully I will have more chances to obtain that goal next year. My plans, like most people, have dramatically changed because of the COVID-19 global pandemic." Flores was originally going to stay in Atlanta this summer to take classes and train. Now she's headed back to Fort Dodge. "I'll be coming back to Iowa next week," said Flores, who just finished up finals for her spring semester and will start summer online work this Monday. "I can practice with my dad back home and enjoy a peaceful break with my parents. If things open back up down in Kansas City, I can train there as well. That's where I spent the majority of last summer." There are obviously no tournaments or anything like that planned anytime soon. All tours and circuits are banned until July. So for now, I'm just going to enjoy some time off and then start to train again. Flores is majoring in business administration with a concentration in strategy and innovation. Her minor is science, technology, and society. Flores is a former junior main draw qualifier for both Wimbledon and the U.S. Open. Before arriving at Georgia Tech, she had obtained a top 50 ITF junior world ranking. Flores and Jones went 15-1 overall in dual doubles matches and 6-0 in the ACC, all from the number one position in the lineup. The tandem reeled off 8 consecutive wins to end the year and went a perfect 7-0 against nationally rated opponents. Only 10 doubles teams were recognized nationally. I'm so proud of both Kenya and Victoria on achieving ITA All-American status, Yellow Jacket head coach Rodney Harmon said. They both played so well this past season and are very deserving of this recognition. Jones, now a 4-time All-American who tied Flores with a team-best 20-match victories, earned ITA singles honors as well. Wrestling enthusiast McCool passes away at 60. The sport of wrestling lost one of its best storytellers on Monday, as longtime wrestling reporter Dan McCool passed away at the age of 60. McCool, a Clarion native, was well known for his love of the sport and his ability to tell wrestler's story in print. Dan was one of the best, said Iowa head wrestling coach Tom Brands in an exclusive interview with The Messenger. He told stories to keep the legacies of native Iowa wrestlers alive. It was important to him that Iowa's best wrestlers were never forgotten. He had relationships that he was proud of, and he guarded them fiercely. In the end, he is the one that will never be forgotten. Anytime Fort Dodge wrestling coach Bobby Thompson was at a wrestling meet, McCool was always there to talk about wrestling or share a laugh. He had such an approachable personality, whether you were wearing a suit or blue jeans, Thompson said. Cooley was known for his light humor and his sarcasm. I can't tell you the number of events that I would see him at. When I was at the Olympic trials in Indianapolis or the junior and cadet teams, I would see him there. Anytime there was a major event, I would walk in and Cooley would be there. McCool was known for his love of the sport at all ages. He covered high school, college, and Olympic events. If there was a big event, he was there. He was an icon of wrestling, Thompson said. He was an encyclopedia of knowledge. It's hard to put into words the knowledge of wrestling that he'll take to his grave. The stories that he could tell, not only in high school, but at the college and the Olympic level. A lot of people don't know, but he was also very knowledgeable with baseball and other sports and had a vast appreciation for the state of Iowa. Thompson wants the younger wrestlers and the wrestling community to understand what McCool meant to the sport of wrestling. I hope the younger generations appreciate what he did for the sport of wrestling. Editorial. Nurses remain dedicated to caring for all. National Nurse Week begins today. There is perhaps no profession that is so intertwined with an individual's life as nursing is. Nurses are there to help bring new life into the world. They administer the vaccines and help people get through all the various illnesses and injuries of a lifetime. And at the very end, nurses care for people in their last days. Nurses provide care in the form of medicine and therapy, but they also provide it in the form of reassuring words and a comforting presence. In light of what they do for all of us, it is highly appropriate that we spend a little time honoring them. National Nurse Week begins today and ends May 12th. It has been marked every year since 1974, when former President Richard Nixon signed a proclamation establishing it. There is a significance to the timing of National Nurse Week. It always concludes on May 12th, which was the birthday of Florence Nightingale, who is widely regarded as the person who created professional nursing. She worked in British hospitals during the Crimean War, a largely forgotten conflict that pitted Britain, France, and the Ottoman Empire against Russia from 1853 to 1856. Her strict rules on sanitation, which included requiring hospital staff members to wash their hands often, are credited with drastically reducing the death rate in the hospitals. In 1860, she established the world's first professional nursing school in London. The skills and knowledge of nurses have expanded rapidly since then to the benefit of humanity. Other elements of the profession have changed, too. For example, growing numbers of men have joined the ranks of nurses recently. Unity Point Health Fort Dodge employs 377 nurses at its various facilities. There are dozens more nurses employed at local nursing homes, care facilities, home care services, schools, and the Webster County Public Health Department. All of them are here to care for all of us. We are humbled by their dedication. All we can say is thank you. You are listening to the reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, May 6th, 2020 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. At this time, we would typically turn to the obituaries, but there are none, so we will continue with the news. Advice from her father carries Joanne Kirsten Hudson through tough times. When she was growing up in Fort Dodge and things would go wrong, Joanne Kirsten Hudson recalls the simple, direct advice of her father. He would always say, "Tough bounce, you just do the best you can at whatever you're doing," she said, in recalling the words of Dr. Herb Kirsten, a surgeon who practiced for 50 years with his brothers John, an internist, and Paul, a psychiatrist, at the Kirsten Clinic, and their father, Dr. E. M. Kirsten, a surgeon who founded the clinic. He meant, life isn't always fair, but you have to move on. Get past it. Don't whine. He was a very compassionate person, but didn't allow complaining or whining. My parents had huge influence on me. They imparted a strong work ethic to treat everybody with respect. I think my parents were the best role models I ever had. Hudson has been a real estate agent in the Chicago area for 30 years and in January was featured on the cover of the North Shore Real Producers magazine, which noted that she's among the top 1% of real estate brokers in the nation, with career volume of $500 million and total sales volume in 2019 of more than $40 million. "The harder I work, the luckier I get," she told the magazine. "Success, to me, is being good at what I do, adding value to the people and the world in which we all live together, while never sacrificing my standards." 2 months after the article appeared, the coronavirus pandemic struck, and like everyone, her personal and professional life has been turned upside down. "The city of Chicago and the town in which I live are in Cook County, and year-to-date, as of last Wednesday, Cook County has 31,953 confirmed coronavirus cases and 1,347 deaths, the most in the city. On April 24th, there were 2,724 new cases reported in the last 24 hours in Cook County, so we are not through this by any stretch. The town in which I live has a population of about 12,400, and we have over 100 confirmed cases. Chicago is continuing the stay-at-home order through the end of May, so we will see this continue." Hudson said the most challenging time of her career came after the stock markets crashed in 2008. "My husband Steve and I owned our own company, had salaries to pay for our employees, and office and marketing expenses. 2008 through 2011 were our toughest years. Our entire financial system was in jeopardy, and the vast majority of my clients were extremely concerned. Many people lost their jobs, mortgages were unpaid, and housing prices dropped. This crisis is different. Our financial systems and our economy in general are in good shape, so the underlying issue is purely COVID-related and how it affects our economy. Many employers have laid off 30 to 50% of their workforce, and many who still have jobs have seen significant salary adjustments as this storm is weathered. We need to get everyone tested and, ultimately, a vaccine. This won't be an instantaneous recovery, but it will come." In both instances, she has paid heed to that advice from her father. "Accept the tough bounce and make the best of the situation. I am doing the vast majority of my showings," she said, "especially the initial showings, virtually via short movies I have of me showing them through the property. FaceTime live with the potential clients, or I wait in the car and they go through on their own with gloves, masks, and not touching anything. Some of my clients have pre-existing conditions, so we do not go into their homes at all, and some of those sellers actually walk them through via FaceTime. I'm getting a large number of calls from people who live in the city who had planned to send their kids to camps this summer, but all have been canceled, so they are calling about my listing with pools, large yards, or those near Lake Michigan, to see if my clients would consider renting to them for the summer. I have reworded most of my listing descriptions to include wording about green space, private offices at homes, staycations, lush yards, pools, near beach, and so on, to make sure my listings stay at the top of buyers' internet searches. People still need to move for all of the traditional reasons: new jobs, upsizing or downsizing, divorce, deaths. So we are continuing to be busy. The last several closings I have had have been in separate cars outside the title companies. People use their own pens and use new gloves and masks before they handle any paperwork. Our governor has also instituted a new ordinance that we all need to wear masks when out in public in close proximity to other people, so that will be enforced for a while too. Joanne and her brother Jim are twins born in 1960 to Cece and Herb Kirsten, joining their older brother Ernie and sister Amy. All three of her siblings live in Fort Dodge. Amy Bruno is program director for the Fort Dodge Community Foundation. Ernie is an attorney in private practice, and Jim is vice president of external affairs and government relations at Iowa Central Community College. They have 15 first cousins who are the children of their dad's brothers, John, Paul, and Don, who was a longtime Fort Dodge attorney, and sister Frances Ann Wolfe. Two of the first cousins, Ann and Steve, live in Fort Dodge, and Kathleen Rothler lives in Emmitsburg. All of us were amazingly close, Hudson said. We've been doing Zoom coffee hours with the girl cousins. Every Thanksgiving, as many of us as possible get back to Fort Dodge for Thanksgiving. For my kids, it's a highlight holiday. Joanne and her husband, Steve, live in Winnetka, Illinois, and are the parents of two children, Forrest, 25, who works with them in real estate, and Amy, 22, who graduated from DePaul University in Chicago and is a tech recruiter for Concero in Chicago. Among her favorite memories of growing up in Fort Dodge are detasseling corn and walking beans for summer jobs, working at Yonkers, riding her bike with friends into the high school to teach swimming lessons, parades down Central Avenue, driving along the Des Moines River, Easter egg hunts at Olson Park, day camp at Dolliver Memorial State Park, picnics in the evening on the family farm west of town, sledding at the farm, and canoeing on the Des Moines River. Through schooling at Fieldhaver Elementary, North Junior High, and Fort Dodge Senior High School, Hudson had a number of teachers who meant much to her career. She remains in touch with two of them, Ken Severson, who is yearbook advisor, and his wife Andrea, who taught geometry. They live at Friendship Haven. Another favorite teacher was Dennis Hewitt, who taught physics. She earned a bachelor's degree in marketing at the University of Iowa in 1983 and moved to Chicago to start her career, at First Chicago, now J.P. Morgan Chase, where she met Steve. They were married at Corpus Christi Church in Fort Dodge in 1988. After 6 years in banking, she decided to branch out on her own, and Steve, who earlier had been involved with commercial real estate financing in Dallas, suggested she try real estate. She got her real estate license in 1990 and first worked for a small boutique firm in Chicago, Erdenberg Otten, and then the North Shore firm Bradbury, Romy, and Egan until 2001 when she and Steve co-founded the Hudson Company in Winnetka, 20 miles north of Chicago on Lake Michigan. It was May 2001, 4 months before the 9/11 terrorist attacks. After 9/11, we did not get one contract in 6 months, either with a buyer or seller. But within the next 12 months, we reached our first-year goal. Their focus was primarily on the five communities that feed into the new Trier Township High School in Winnetka, single-family homes, condominiums, and smaller multi-unit buildings. They had 25 brokers working for the company. They sold their company in 2018 to Compass, a real estate technology company based in New York with offices in the top markets across the country. Joanne and her team at Compass, the Joanne Hudson Group, which includes her son Forrest, serve the North Shore and City of Chicago, specializing in selling single-family homes, condos, co-ops, and multi-unit residential buildings. Her husband Steve is a manager for several North Shore offices at Compass. They continue to work out of the same office in Winnetka, where they worked for almost 18 years when they owned the Hudson Company. Hudson said she is grateful for how I was raised, getting to grow up when I did. Another thing I'm really thankful for, there was no social media to interrupt my childhood and high school years. That made everything more genuine. Hudson still recalls being part of a group of high school seniors who were caught by Fort Dodge police when, for their senior prank, they put animals, a goat, a pig, a duck, and some chickens, in the courtyard of FDSH in the middle of the night. We had to go to the police station and call our parents, she said. My brother Jim and I tossed a coin to see who had to be the one to call our parents. They were not going to be happy. I lost and had to make the fateful call. My dad, who was strict but always reasonable with us and who had an unparalleled moral compass, thought it was funny. Phew! Rallying around one of our own, the Springer family has always been there for Fort Dodge. Now it's time to return the favor. Love and fight. That's all Steve Springer can do these days in the shadow of a life-altering diagnosis. Nearly 2 months ago, the 59-year-old Fort Dodge resident was told he has stage 4 esophageal cancer. The disease has metastasized in his stomach, liver, adrenal glands, blood, and bones. The prognosis was obviously traumatic to the Springer family. Steve, his wife Julie, and their sons, fellow Fort Dodgers Sean, Shay, and Sawyer. It's the kind of devastating news that permanently changes the perspective and priorities of everyone involved. So there are no guarantees anymore when it comes to time. Yes, Steve has never been big on treating time as his own. Anyone in our community knows Steve and Julie are ubiquitous in their efforts to promote Fort Dodge. Steve works at Avella Bank, owns and operates the increasingly popular Snack Shack, has served on the Fort Dodge Community School District Board of Education for the last 7 years, has been a longtime member of the Fort Dodge Athletic Booster Club, was a founding father of the Fort Dodge Baseball Association and its Bat Cave Project, handled concessions and other activities at state cross country and many other athletic events, and has been actively involved in Shellebration, Sertoma Sundowners, Noon Lions, and Girl Scouts of Lakota Council, just to name a few. Steve is at ball games, fundraisers, dinners, plays, charity functions, you name it, and he's probably been there, lending a helping hand. The same can be said for Julie, who has been volunteering tirelessly while also staying active in coaching cheer, serving on the Fort Dodge Community Schools Foundation Board, and booster clubs at both Cooper Elementary and FDSH. The Springers have lived the Fort Dodge way through commitment, selflessness, and sacrifice. They've done so much behind the scenes while asking for very little in return. Steve won't necessarily be happy with me for writing this. Not only does he shy away from attention, but he has zero interest in being pitied. In a recent message exchange, Steve almost immediately shifted the focus away from his own misfortune, saying, "I hurt physically, but others have pain in their own lives at whatever level." It's hard when a person so used to giving is suddenly on the receiving end. Steve is going to have to get used to it, though. We want to rally around him with a word of encouragement, a prayer, a helping hand, or a simple kind gesture. Anything to let Steve know he is far from alone in his battle. Because on the tough days, physically and mentally, when the intense chemotherapy treatments wear on him and the drive back and forth from Fort Dodge to Mary Greeley Hospital in Ames feels like too much, the support from the community he's devoted his life to will be what inspires him. There is no silver lining to an advanced cancer diagnosis. It's cruel and unfair. Steve doesn't deserve any of this, and his family doesn't either. The hope now, in the days and weeks to come, is that Steve sees just how much Fort Dodge has appreciated his hard work and loyalty through the years. We are who we are because of people like Steve and families like the Springers, and we should let Steve, Julie, and the boys know in as many ways as we can. Steve, a 1979 St. Edmund graduate, said to me the other day, "I pray for the good. I need to open my eyes and heart more. I live in a community that pours out love and support to me daily. I'm a little blip in the big pond." He may feel like a little blip when he's in the trenches, but all of those little blips make a big ripple in that pond we call home. So Steve Springer controls what he can now, tries to keep a positive mental attitude, enjoys the moments as they come. He'll love, he'll fight. Out of respect for what Steve has meant to Fort Dodge, the least we can do is keeping loving and fighting for him in return. Judge restores New York Democratic presidential primary on June 23rd. The New York Democratic presidential primary must take place June 23rd because canceling it would be unconstitutional, a judge ruled Tuesday. U.S. District Judge Annalisa Torres in Manhattan ruled after hearing arguments a day earlier as lawyers for withdrawn presidential candidates Bernie Sanders and Andrew Yang argued that it was wrong to cancel the primary. The judge said there was enough time before the primary occurs to figure out how to carry it out safely. If all but one of the presidential candidates are removed from the ballot and the primary is not held, delegate plaintiffs will be deprived of the opportunity to compete for delegate slots and shape the course of events at the convention, and voters will lose the chance to express their support for delegates who share their views, the judge wrote. The loss of these First Amendment rights is a heavy hardship. She added, there is also a strong public interest in permitting the presidential primary to proceed with the full roster of qualified candidates. The Democratic members of the state's Board of Elections voted to cancel the primary, even though New York was still planning to hold its congressional and state-level primaries June 23rd. They cited the danger to voters from the coronavirus as a reason to cancel the election, since former Vice President Joe Biden has been endorsed by the major candidates he had faced. New York State Democratic Party Chair Jay Jacobs said, "We are reviewing it." Jacobs had called holding the primary unnecessary with the suspension of Sanders' campaign and said reduced turnout could reduce the need for as many poll workers. Lawyers who argued before Torres on Monday did not immediately return calls seeking comment. AP courtside, Supreme Court finishes day two of phone argument. Supreme Court finishes day two of phone argument. The Supreme Court is hearing a second day of arguments by telephone with the audio available live to audiences around the world. Monday was the justices' first foray into the setup they settled on because of the coronavirus pandemic. After hearing Tuesday's case, the justices will have four scheduled days of argument and eight cases remaining. The highest profile cases are scheduled for next week. That's when the justices will hear cases, including President Donald Trump's bid to keep certain financial records private. With camps shut, families face summer in the great indoors. Welcome to the summer in the great indoors. Parents around the country are learning their children's summer camps will be canceled, delayed, or moved online as the fallout from the coronavirus seeps into another facet of American life. From New Hampshire to California, camps and parents are scrambling as Zoom campfires and virtual cabins in the living room become more likely. It's a blow for children and their parents who have spent weeks cooped up during school closures and had considered camp a reward for adhering to weeks of social isolation and homeschooling. It also will squeeze nonprofits that rely on the infusion of cash from camp payments and put young counselors out of work. When we finally found out that schools were going to be closed for the rest of the year, I was like, well, there's always summer camp. I was really holding out for that, said Rasha Habibi of Los Angeles. Her 10-year-old's daughter's first ever sleepaway camp has been canceled, and they're both devastated. Habibi and her husband have demanding work schedules, but kept their kids away from her parents to avoid possibly spreading the virus. Now, she said she may be forced to ask them to babysit. I panic, I cry, I do all those things. But what other options are there? Habibi said. I know we're not the only ones in this situation. I'm keenly aware of that, but somehow it doesn't make it any easier. An estimated 20 million U.S. children attend summer camp each year, fueling an $18 billion industry that employs over a million seasonal workers, according to the American Camp Association. The association, which represents more than 3,100 camps, has hired independent health experts to draft recommendations for camps, and many still hope to open, said Tom Rosenberg, group president and CEO. Camps also are awaiting guidance from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and input from state and local health departments, he said. Most camps are not asking if they're going to open, but how they're going to open. It's essential, Rosenberg said. Right now, 20 million kids that would normally be going to camp are cast adrift in a sea of screens. Camp Walt Whitman, a 7-week overnight camp in New Hampshire's remote White Mountains, sent parents a letter with three options: canceling, postponing, or going forward with social distancing and other precautions. The camp, which charges $13,000 for the full session, will decide after May 20th, Director Jed Dorfman said. For smaller camps, canceling could mean financial ruin. Many nonprofits rely on camp fees for their budgets and to pay contracts signed in advance. Some that have canceled are urging parents to donate all or part of the tuition or apply it to next year. That backfired for Galileo Learning, a San Francisco area camp that enrolls thousands of children after it canceled and credited families for next year. After an outcry, the company asked parents whether they would like a full or partial refund or a credit. A Galileo statement said that it had laid off or furloughed more than 80% of year-round staff. Other camps are racing to move online. Interlochen Arts Camp, which enrolls 2,800 kids and teens from 50 countries in its prestigious summer program in Michigan, will switch to virtual lessons and workshops while making the season shorter, President Trey Davey said. The Girl Scouts of Oregon and Southwest Washington canceled in-person camps for thousands, but will roll out virtual experiences in June, said Allie Roberts, director of programs for the Girl Scouts in 33 Oregon counties and 3 counties in Washington state. The Girl Scouts' 111 councils nationwide are each finding an approach that suits their region and membership. It's a heartbreaking decision, but it's the right decision for the safety of our girls, Roberts said. Other camps are shutting down completely. Administrators in Florida realized it was impossible to practice proper social distancing at Camp Kiwanis, a sleepaway camp tucked along a lake in the Ocala National Forest. Each week, over 100 kids spend 4 nights and then go back to their homes in Marion County, which is seeing new coronavirus cases daily, Camp Director Scott Mitchell said. The camp has been a fixture for 72 years, and 1/4 of the children get scholarships from the local Kiwanis Club, he said. Go on Netflix and find the cheesiest summer camp movie you can find, and that's us. It's a traditional, good old-fashioned summer camp, Mitchell said. It's kind of a sad day for our community. But if you look at other places that have really been hit, it's a small price to pay. Still, it's a bitter pill to swallow for many, including young people who have started to expect disappointment as the pandemic drags on. Delia Graham, 15, was ecstatic to spend 6 weeks at Willowbrook Arts Camp, where she's been going since age 5. She's old enough to work as a half-day counselor, a step toward becoming a full-fledged staffer at the popular drama and arts camp near Portland, Oregon. Graham and 5 camp friends spent days in a FaceTime group chat debating what would happen before getting the bad news, said Graham, who had already been struggling with her school's closure. I didn't think it would get so bad, that it would last this long, she said of the pandemic. I really miss my friends. Barack Obama will headline televised primetime commencement. Former President Barack Obama will deliver a televised primetime commencement address for the high school class of 2020 during an hour-long event that will also feature LeBron James, Malala Yousafzai, and Ben Platt, among others. ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC will simultaneously air the special May 16th at 7 p.m. CDT, along with more than 20 other broadcast and digital streaming partners, according to the announcement Tuesday from organizers. Several high school students from Chicago Public Schools and the Obama Youth Jobs Corps will join, as well as the Jonas Brothers, Yara Shahidi, Bad Bunny, Lena Waithe, Pharrell Williams, Megan Rapinoe, and H.E.R. The event is titled Graduate Together, America Honors the High School Class of 2020. It's hosted by the education advocacy group XQ Institute, the LeBron James Family Foundation, and the Entertainment Industry Foundation. Obama will reflect on the COVID-19 pandemic's disruption of school life, especially for seniors who have missed out on their milestone rites of passage. This high school graduation season will be anything but ordinary, but that's all the more reason why the class of 2020 deserves extraordinary advice, heartfelt encouragement, and hard-won wisdom about facing new challenges in an uncertain world, Ruslan Ali, CEO and co-founder of XQ Institute, said in a statement. We are grateful to President Obama for giving this gift to our nation's 3 million high school seniors as they graduate together, she added. And that does it for today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger for Wednesday, May 6th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. What exactly is fossil water, and why have we consumed so much of it? No, it's not a new brand of bottled water imported from the days of dinosaurs. Fossil water came from melting ice sheets, ancient lake systems, and a generally wetter climate tens to hundreds of thousands of years ago. It percolated into porous rocks, which were then buried under deep layers of sediment, where it was sealed off from the surface, and there it stayed, until farmers discovered it. And in the second half of the 20th century, they started drilling wells into fossil aquifers and pumping like mad, turning sunny, dry places into acres and acres of green farmland. Crop supplies boomed. Food became cheaper and more plentiful, grown in formerly parched places like California and Kansas, and shipped around the world for people like you and me to eat, ingesting fossil water with it. The trouble is, fossil water is a finite resource, and new studies suggest that many fossil aquifers may become depleted this century, so that we won't be able to rely on them any longer. This could mean that the crops that depend on them could become less plentiful and more expensive again. All the while, population will likely increase, the climate will likely warm, our demand for water will continue to climb, which means we'll have to adapt to the lack of fossil water, just as we adapted to its discovery, this time with more efficient crops and farming methods and more efficient use. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.